You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Just keep rolling along.
sweat and strain, body all aching and racked with pain. Tote that bot, lift that bale, you get a little drunk and your land's in jail. I get weary and sick of trying. I'm tired of living and scared of dying. But old man River, he just keeps rolling along. Dark is awake on the Mississippi. Dark is awake while the white folks play. Pulling those boats from the dawn till sunset, getting no rest till the judgment day.
Don't know God and don't look down, you don't last name the white horse crown. Bend your ears and bow your head and pull that rope until you're dead.
Let me go away from the Mississippi, let me go away from the white man boss. Show me that stream called the River Jordan. That's the old stream that I long to cross.
Old man River, that old man River, he must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling. Along
a river forever keeps rolling on.
Old man River, he don't mind him, and them that plants him, he's soon forgotten. But old man River, he just keeps rolling.
Along a river keeps hearing that song. You and me, we sweat and strain, body all aching and racked with pain. Tote that barge, lift that bale, you get a little drunk and your land's in jail.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and that was Old Man River from Paul Robeson, one of the greatest African-American singers who ever lived. Now, of course, we're in Black History Month right now, and just yesterday, on February 5th, Friday, February 5th, there was an all-day CFRU Black History Month, all-day programming, all day black programming, you know, which is a really beautiful thing. I really wish more stations would do that during this month. You know, we're really celebrating African American histories, the struggles of African American people. And of course, I kind of started getting into that a bit last week when I talked about, specifically about racism in North America, racial apartheid in North America, and how the concept of whiteness fits into that. You know, this kind of colonial concept of whiteness that was designed as a social control mechanism by the colonial elite in the colonies that would become the United States. And how that was used not only to keep black people in line, people of African descent in line, it was also used to keep workers of European descent in line. And that's been the case in North America ever since. You know, and how this racial divide that was artificially created has been used by ruling class interests to further their profits, basically, and as a mechanism of social control. That's what I was talking about last week. And earlier this week, there was an open mic. Well Spoken Word does a open mic at the Red Brick Cafe every month, the first Tuesday of every month here in Guelph. And I went there, and in honor of Black History Month, though this, as I told them, this piece should be, you know, should be spoken, should be performed, should be publicizing, let's say, throughout the year, given the power, the impact that it really has, the power of this piece. I read My Dungeon Shook, a piece by African-American journalist James Baldwin. My Dungeon Shook, Letter to My Nephew on the 100th Anniversary of the Emancipation, which is a letter to his nephew, which he wrote in 1963, really about what it meant to be a black man in the United States. And really it expanded into race relations in general and talked about what it was all about. You know, really unpacked it in a way that I've really never seen before. And that's why I decided to perform that, and because it really has a message, you know, for white people as well as black people in these words, you know, and that's why I really want to do it on this show here tonight. Now, there are two main people I'm going to talk about on the show here tonight. You know, I'm going to be doing, over the next few weeks, of course, I'm going to be doing shows surrounding Black History Month. But this week, I really want to talk about the two people I've mentioned since the show began. That was Paul Robeson and James Baldwin. You know, they're different people, but of course they're coming out of a similar environment. You know, in this, the United States, the racial apartheid state of the United States. You know, in the 20th century. And the common experiences coming out of that, and like how they approach the world, how they approach their careers, the kind of message that they wanted to convey throughout their lives was very much shaped by where they came from, how they grew up, the material conditions they lived in. So I'm going to talk about that here tonight. I'm going to try to not to speak very much myself. I'm going to try to let them tell their own story, because I have like some interviews that they did, some speeches that they gave lined up, and I think that's really going to capture what they were all about. These two men, really extraordinary men, African American men. It's going to capture really what they're all about better than anything I can say. But to start things off, I really want to do this piece, which I did do at the open mic, My Dungeon Shook. Read you an excerpt from that. I prefaced it when I performed it at the Red Brick Cafe earlier this week. I prefaced it by, because it was mostly a white audience in the room. So what I said to them, I had a bit of a message to white people, keeping in line from the message which the show was all about last week, you know, talking about the white race and how it was created and the destructive impact that it's had, and the need for white people to understand whiteness, understand history, their own history, and come to grips with that if they want to tackle racism, if they want to really seriously, if we seriously want to deal with racism in our society. I said, "Dear white people, every people in the world understands the concept of self-determination, except for us. And this is our problem. This is what we have to face, this is what we must understand, and this is what we must change." And really, that was last week's show in a nutshell, that message. But really, I couldn't have really given that kind of message, and I couldn't have done last week's show, for that matter, without having first read the message that James Baldwin had in this piece, which I'm about to read. So I'm going to read an excerpt from My Dungeon Shook, Letter to My Nephew on the 100th Anniversary of the Emancipation, by James Baldwin. "Well, you were born. Here you came. Something like 14 years ago. And though your father and mother and grandmother, looking about the streets through which they were carrying you, staring at the walls into which they brought you, had every reason to be heavy-hearted, yet they were not. For here you were, Big James, named for me. You were a big baby. I was not. Here you were, to be loved. To be loved, baby, hard at once and forever. To strengthen you against the loveless world. Remember that. I know how dark it looks today, for you. It looked bad that day, too. Yes, we were trembling. We have not stopped trembling yet. But if we had not loved each other, none of us would have survived. And now you must survive because we love you. And for the sake of your children and your children's children. This innocent country set you down in a ghetto in which, in fact, it intended that you should perish. Let me spell out precisely what I mean by that. For the heart of the matter is here, and the root of my dispute with my country. You were born where you were born, and faced the future that you faced because you were black and for no other reason. The limits of your ambition were thus expected to be set forever. You were born into a society which spelled out with brutal clarity and in as many ways as possible that you were a worthless human being. You were not expected to aspire to excellence. You were expected to make peace with mediocrity. Wherever you have turned, James, in your short time on this earth, you have been told where you could go and what you could do and how you could do it and where you could do it and whom you could marry. I know that your countrymen do not agree with me about this. I hear them saying you exaggerate. But they do not know Harlem, and I do. So do you. Take no one's word for anything, including mine, but trust your experience. Know whence you came. If you know whence you came, there is really no limit to where you can go. The details and symbols of your life have been deliberately constructed to make you believe what white people say about you. Please try to remember that what they believe, as well as what they do and cause you to endure, does not testify to your inferiority, but to their inhumanity and fear. Please try to be clear, dear James, through the storm which rages about your youthful head today, about the reality which lies behind the words acceptance and integration. There is no reason for you to try to become like white people, and there is no basis whatever for their impertinent assumption that they must accept you. The really terrible thing, old buddy, is that you must accept them. And I mean that very seriously. You must accept them and accept them with love. For these innocent people have no other hope. They are, in effect, still trapped in a history which they do not understand, and until they understand it, they cannot be released from it. They have had to believe for so many years and for innumerable reasons that black men are inferior to white men. Many of them indeed know better, but as you will discover, people find it very difficult to act on what they know. To act is to be committed, and to be committed is to be in danger. In this case, the danger in the minds of most white Americans is the loss of identity. Try to imagine how you would feel if you woke up one morning to find the sun shining and all the stars aflame. You would be frightened, because it is against the order of nature. Any upheaval in the universe is terrifying because it so profoundly attacks one's sense of one's own reality. Well, the black man has functioned in the white man's world as a fixed star, as an immovable pillar. And as he moves out of his place, heaven and earth are shaken to their foundations. But you, don't be afraid. I said that it was intended that you should perish in the ghetto, perish by never being allowed to go behind the white man's definitions, by never being allowed to spell your proper name. You have, and many of us have, defeated this intention. And by a terrible law, a terrible paradox, those innocents who believed that your imprisonment made them safe are losing their grasp of reality. But these men are your brothers, your lost younger brothers. And if the word integration means anything, this is what it means. That we, with love, shall force our brothers to see themselves as they are, to cease fleeing from reality and begin to change it. For this is your home, my friend. Do not be driven from it. Great men have done great things here, and will again. And we will make America what America must become. It will be hard, James, but you come from sturdy peasant stock, men who picked cotton and dammed rivers and built railroads, and in the teeth of the most terrifying odds, achieved an unassailable and monumental dignity. You come from a long line of poets, some of the greatest poets since Homer. One of them said, "The very time I thought I was lost, my dungeon shook and my chains fell off." You know, and I know, that the country is celebrating 100 years of freedom 100 years too soon. We cannot be free until they are free. God bless you, James, and Godspeed. Your Uncle James. That's my dungeon shook. Letter to my nephew on the 100th anniversary of the emancipation by James Baldwin. African-American journalist and a gay man. A homosexual. And he faced repression on both counts, the fact that he was black and the fact that he was gay. And he grew up in poverty. He had to face many, many obstacles throughout his life. Just being able to get to the point where he could speak those words and bring his message forward and communicate that. And the same thing had to go with Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson, one of the things I should have told you, in fact, just after I played the song which he did on the at the beginning of the program, Old Man River, which is a song from the movie Showboat, a musical, which was performed in 1936 is when Paul Robeson acted in that. Paul Robeson was an actor. He was a star football player. He was one of the greatest African-American singers of all time. He was a towering figure throughout his life, and he was an internationalist. He was a communist. He was somebody who went to Spain and sang with the international brigades during the Spanish Civil War. He sang with striking Welsh miners in coal mining towns in Wales. You know, he went to the Soviet Union, you know, and participated in the building of socialism there and felt at home there. You know, he said for the first time in his life, he felt like a free man when he went to a complete human being, when he went to the Soviet Union. And of course, remember, he grew up, of course, in apartheid North America. You know, where he was not treated as an equal by any means and had to fight for everything. You know, where he, of course, he could have been a lawyer. He did all the training to be a lawyer, but of course was denied the right to practice it. Because all kinds of barriers came up in front of him because, of course, he was a black man. That's why he decided to go into a career in the stage and in music. But, of course, he was a brilliant man. Like, he excelled in virtually everything he tried. You know, and he reached so many people through his music. He reached my own grandfather through his music. You know, my granddad who came from a coal mining town in northern England. And yet, like, you know, Paul Robeson, through his voice, could reach him. You know, build a connection there. You know, between this working class person living in a coal mining town in northern England, or a factory town in Coventry in the Midlands in England, you know, it could connect with him. You know, the experience of African Americans. You know, have had to struggle. You know, in the face of slavery, in the face of bond labor, in the face of Jim Crow laws, in the face of police violence, segregation, you name it. You know, that experience could connect with my own granddad. You know, as a working class person, it could. And that's what Paul Robeson did. He built bridges. He built connections. And that's what made him so great. He was such an internationalist in that way. You know, and when he went before the House on American Committees, when he was called to testify before during the McCarthyite witch hunts, in the 1950s, you know, and they asked him, when he, of course, openly said, you know, he respected the Soviet Union and he felt at home in the Soviet Union. He felt like a free human being in the Soviet Union. You know, these bigoted anti-communist senators who were running the whole charade basically said, okay, why don't you just go back to Russia then? And he said, because my father was a slave. You know, he suffered to build this country. You know, I own a piece of this country and no fascist-minded person will ever drive me from it. You know, this is my land. You know, it's one of the most defiant things which I really ever heard. You know, the most profound. It's very difficult to even put that into words. You know, so you have these two men, James Baldwin and Paul Robeson, who are paying tribute to here tonight. So I think without further ado, I'm going to play a song, and then I'm going to get into a speech that James Baldwin gave in 1963. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Most y'all ain't ready for this. I'm gonna talk about some things I hear that many people won't appreciate. I was raised in streets so cold where hopes rose, where little kids walk around with no clothes, and not because they have no homes, but this is how they were shown, how to live too fast and act too grown, where most live so high yet only know lows, never learn how to stand on their own cause they always face life on their toes, when this concrete jungle with all of its woes, that roses in Harlem that somehow still grow, and I suppose with more tilling their flowers will show, nurture the children and the wind will blow, and the world would be a better place instead of the cheddar race, or if not a threat to humanity we will forever face, cause round my block the youth are used as modern day pawns, hustling death till there's nothing left from dusk to dawn, till every last bit of their soul is gone, and they forever travel in shadows to live life amongst the storm, wishing they could be reborn, looking for a jack to feed on, and some of them mentally be gone, and since they never got their read on, they never understood why I was a born for them to see their seed born, so the next generation grieves on and bleeds on, and this can happen for eons, unless we form a legion to attack these demons, I wanna stop our breathing, so we can't inhale freedom, how many of our kids have asthma due to the plaster, how many of our family members suffer from cancer, still look at this government for answers, how many of our youth throw bananas at the color of bandanas, cause their minds have been desensitized by the time they finish failing grandma, live most of their lives failing grandma in the slammer, trying to make runs from the slums of New York to Atlanta, didn't know the difference between a Black Panther and a white panda, both were extinct animals if you asked them, but if you couldn't mask them and examine and show them all the horror in their lives, they observed the curve random was due to years of steady planning, our people have been left stranded and abandoned, trapped in way before Katrina ever happened, it's my greater passion that might move them into action, to take their freedom of their people without asking, without vote casting, cause that hasn't ever had an effect on those who haven't, the have-nots who never had it, never could get it, raised to be addicts, I wish the whole hood would shed it, crackers and embedded so far in our neighborhoods, community boards are segmented. Most people we thought represented us were demented, looking at 401k pensions instead of where these land grabbers were headed. Just get a big prevented buildings which are rented. Now you need a mortgage and for the poor kids, the playgrounds are now fenced. So you can see how the young side stemming from a life of untold knocks. Run away from homes with no pops and hand me down jeans or old socks. Away from their mom that pops. It can clearly see the traction of arms will only lead to a cold box. And this is why they run nonstop, especially from cold cops. And blocks that have been co-op, but there's no options, pelvis crop. Went into a cyphers of no-knots, that road pot and whole blocks. But the dough got them in 30 below, pushing snow like they robots. To be sent up, stained, and smothered where the poles lock. And this is to the youth that everyone forgot. But my purpose is to convince you, the lyrical use at its pinnacle. To show you how the system can make you utterly cynical. How you tired from a mental umbilical, why you're skeptical, about your freedom even being perceptible. Why breaking free is questionable, but freedom is so visible, beyond their economic principles. As emancipation can't be divisible by 10, so won't be related to anything you spend, nothing you can lend, no affiliation to the dollar, euro, yen, freedom will look like no gem, couldn't tell you all by the number of inches on your rims, no matter how many pairs of tins, or what you wear in your limbs, this is not where freedom begins, but this is exactly where it ends, cause when I speak of liberation, I'm talking
beyond America's upper class imagination, beyond taking long vacations, beyond a house with land the size of the South's largest slave plantation, beyond any payment, freedom is not some external sensation. It's definitely a test of patience. Some say patience is a virtue, others say it may curse you, but I know hesitant cats in your circle would definitely hurt you. Others may think progress must mirror the moves of a turtle, but I'm sure it's a race man at its own pace with many a hurdle. And for all movement, the ground's fertile, so I urge you to purge through. The cops already set a curfew. If they catch you after hours, they definitely search you, might even murk you. Now I rhyme it for the fuck it, but I take this personal. This is reality rap, not in virtue. Back to hell, this to nurse you. Give it a Holy Spirit like church you. For those locked in a metaphorical box, this will help you burst through. Cause the Project Blues, we're just scratching the surface. Now our purpose go to depths like the dollar, show you America's worthless. No matter what you purchase, this downfall is not temporary but permanent. As economist searches for words that won't make investors nervous. Wall Street can't avoid the closing curtains. I'm 100% certain a $1 trillion war's a huge cause for the hurting. Increased rates for Kabul will add to the burden. And 700 military bases for future Vietnam to have lurking. You better off going online, looking to pound conversion, or run down to the bank urgent to buy bonds backed by the Chinese one in person. But no matter how many corporate bailouts and stimulus packages, there'll be perpetual crashes, inevitable clashes between the classes. Years of self-serving for supplies I'm earning. Got them printing the mirrors as fast as they can, cause the dollar's burning. And constructing a super corridor to fortify the North American Union. From Mexico to Canada for international cargo movement. They're fucking shifting humans. As gentrification's a part of a bigger plan of population redistribution, creating super cities trapped by super highways. And you need a passport to even travel sideways. And if you have questions, I have places of preventive detention. Here there's a misinformation obsession. They're in a depression that can barely save recession. They're playing 1984, them all with their aggression. Orwell, the Orwells with their advanced weapons. Now who has pity on a Sunni in Sardar City? See me as a young studious religious boy praying, hoping God is with me. As reality starts to hit me, these American bullets start to rip me. I survived, my sister didn't, so now I'm jihad strictly. Already forgiven, ready to give up living. Deadly with scope precision, blasting at the walls of my hopes in prison. With the hatred of the American fleet that runs really deep, I'ma have a bomb strapped to my chest, but I don't value my life really cheap. This hill I climb is really steep, and only with this IED will the world hear me speak.
One, a baby's not born with any idea of a society, no sense whatever of other people. Its mother exists principally, in fact entirely, for him or her, and its father exists somewhat later, entirely for him or her. It's only much, much later that the baby begins to realize that the parent on whom he depended for everything and whom he supposed held up the world is in fact just another human being who was not invented for him. That is, on the most primary level, one of the meanings of an education. On another level, it is the only way that one is enabled to enlarge the world. Now that sounds like a very grandiose phrase. All it means is that when you, for example, begin to read, you discover more about the world than you knew before. You discover more about the world in two ways, and this is why it is important. There being, in fact, two worlds. One world is you. That this envelope, I'm a world. I'm not the only world, that's my problem. But I'm a world, and I'm under the obligation to discover whatever it is that goes on in that world. And in order to do that, I have got to consent to become a social animal in order to discover and to enlarge what goes on in this world, which is all of you and many millions of people, both living and dead, past and to come. And finally, this is where it begins to be difficult, the measure of one's dignity depends on one's estimate of oneself. It really does not depend, as so many people in this country now seem to believe, on someone else's estimate. It depends, first of all, on what you take yourself to be, what your real standards are, what you think is right, what you think is wrong, what you think life is all about, what you think life is for. Now you are all very young. And I say that, by the way, with great humility. You are all still unformed. Well, let me put it another way. You are not finally formed. And you are still, to put it brutally, I want to put it brutally because I want to make my point absolutely clear. You are still at the mercy of your elders. You are still at the mercy of the standards of your elders. Let us go back again to the whole concept of education. And bear in mind then that education does not and cannot occur in a vacuum. It occurs in a social context. It occurs in a social context, and it has social ends. For example, to take a very brutal example, the children of the Third Reich were educated by the Third Reich in order to fulfill the purposes of the Third Reich. Hitler did this on a very old principle, the principle referred to by priest and in the Bible, and which every parent somewhere knows. If you give me the child for 5 years, I'll have him the rest of his life. So that if that is so, one has then got to be aware that one of the purposes of an education, your responsibility before your educators, is to question the purpose of this education. Let me give you then, your education is occurring within a given context, at a certain time in history, in a certain country, at a certain time in its history. In fact, at a very crucial time in its history. If, for example, well, I'll be personal about this. When I was going to school, a school not very unlike this one, though not as pretty, I began to be bugged by the teaching of American history. I began to be bugged by the teaching of American history because it seemed that that history had been accomplished without my presence. And this had a very demoralizing effect on me when I was your age and younger, and had a demoralizing effect for quite a few years thereafter. Now, that may seem to be trivial, but speaking now as though I were your educator, as though I were your teacher, my responsibility to you would be to invest you with all of the morale that I could to prepare you for the terrible storm which is called life. Terrible and beautiful, but you must know that it is both. And you don't quite know it, and it's my responsibility to make you know it. It's my responsibility also, speaking now as your educator, to give you as true a version of your history as I can, since it is through your sense of your own history that you arrive at your identity. And no one has ever arrived at a sense of his own identity without it. This is why ancestors are important. We, all of us here now, are living through a certain kind of turmoil which endangers all of our relationships. This turmoil is sometimes described as racial. We can use that word for the moment, but it is really not racial. It is historical and it is personal. Let me speak again about the aims of a society, as opposed now to the aims of an education. The aims of a society are and always must be to inculcate in its citizens a certain sense of security and to discourage its citizens from disturbing the peace. Now, this is a necessity, and it is even an admirable necessity, because we cannot live without society, and society as a fact is a very beautiful creation. Nevertheless, it is also equally true that all societies have been brought into existence very painfully and very slowly by men, and the people who are responsible for the creation of societies must forever ask questions, all questions, take nothing whatever for granted, because that is the only way the frontiers of the world fall back, and the world, as I said before, begins to be enlarged. So that this means that though a society is under the obligation to educate all of its citizens, it is also under the obligation to discourage people from thinking too much. Now, this is where all of you come in. My responsibility, again, if I'm your teacher, is to teach you to think. This is not an easy thing to do. If I want you to think, I must teach you to think about everything. I must teach you that there is a reason for everything you do, and that you must find that reason. If, for example, and now I will be personal, I'm afraid, but I mean it in the best possible way. If I were your teacher, and let us say I was dealing with one of you who, let's say in this case, would be a Negro of about 16 or 17, and I knew that you were beginning to wonder what you were doing in school in the first place, and what waited for you outside, what good was it to be here since nothing that happened to you here prepared you for outside. Knowing your bitterness and not trying for a moment to pretend it is not justified, I yet have to suggest to you that the problems that you face, you would have to make them personal. And then I would ask you very rude questions. For example, I would ask you, if you were a boy, why you dressed the way you did, and if your hair was conked, I would ask you to ask yourself, why? To come back again, this is a very small example of what I mean, to the war between society and thought. It is your responsibility as the young American citizens to understand that the standards by which you are confronted and by which many of you are visibly and obviously victimized, and others of you not so obviously but equally victimized, are not the only standards in the world. There is no reason for anybody to want to look like a Greek god. That is not the world's only standard of beauty. And furthermore, the virtues to which we all in one way or another aspire are a comfortable life, which is to say, a middle-class life, are not the only virtues. I come from a very poor family, and there's a vast amount of vitality, which is a very definite virtue, to be found in those circumstances. Finally, if I were your teacher, I would beg you to insist to fight with me and not let me get away with anything. No matter how I may sound, I am really only mortal. And though I love you very much and feel responsible for you, I'm not always right. We depend on each other, the old and the young, to learn from each other. I would beg you to ask me why, for example, your history books are the way they are. And I would beg you to force me to answer if you asked me what relevance your education had for concrete problems such as getting an apartment, moving from one part of town to another. If I were you, I would force me, if I put me on the spot, ask me the most difficult questions that you can. And I will not be able to answer them. But my responsibility is to hear them. And when you ask your question, any question, you begin to know more about what you really think. That's all I have to say. Now you're going to ask me questions.
Sometimes men take matters into their own hands.
Wide awake, six in the morning, still coming at you till the break of dawn, and this revolution goes on and on. Stop that asking, do we still rap? Do y'all still scream and y'all still clap? Who that? Gonna tell y'all we too old, but we still bold. Plus I got soul for birthday, and I'm 50 years quiet as kept. Come on, cause I cracked the code. Who sold the young out, never told them what needs to be told. When they made P.E., they broke the mold. Didn't quit nothing, I just hit the road. I just got back from Soweto. You only know half of what y'all say, y'all know. I know this record's too hot for the radio. Y'all hear what I say, and if you did, let's go. I'm gonna say it and do it like it is. Come on, say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Doing our thing, yeah, doing the right thing. We ain't just said just about anything, just to get those out there material things. I ain't saying we ain't bought anything. Stuck with the rap, never try to sing. Bring the noise, raise the roof, they afraid of the youth. Look out, duck down.
You can't handle the truth.
Now the club ain't no church, and the church ain't no club. Check them DJs mixing up murder and love. Whose shoulders the burden of all that murdering? The people, love spelled backwards is evil. Misspelled, what the hell? The people get pain. Dumb from another marketing campaign. It's my birthday, and we still killing the stage. I don't give a damn about popping champagne. Say what y'all want to say about change. Revolution, I'ma say what I'm saying. Come on now. Say it like it really is. Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
But the revolution goes on and on. Still wide awake like six in the morning. Had to get it out through the break of dawn. And we're still saying what we saying and not playing, y'all. Do it like it really is. Do it like it really is.
For me. It's P.E. bringing the noise. Hit me.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Rather be stuck up than stuck down. Here's
what's the difference where I pick up the black and the brown against Mr. Man, informants and governments, while real people starve and can't pay their rent. And they say, you seriously don't mean what you meant. I ain't tricked to see paid off an agreement. Somebody planned it. Glad y'all understand it. Those that don't, hard-headed like granite. We look out for them too and don't take them for granted. Like said, I said, somebody planned it. If I see one more person gonna ask me again, y'all still making music? Where I begin? Now y'all know you don't buy no records no more. No tapes, no CDs, no record stores. Got download zones and selling tones. But your mama and them can't work them cell phones. But the revolution goes on and on. And still wide awake like 6 in the morning. Had to get it out through the break of dawn. And we'll still say what we saying and not playing, y'all.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it like it really is.
Say it like it really is.
Do it.
Chuck, now you rockin', son. Chuck D, baby.
Do it
like that, Chuck.
Do it
like that.
Listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So we had James Baldwin speaking at the Castle Mountain High School in Oakland, California, the 23rd of June, 1963. It was called The Fire This Time. The speech was called The Fire This Time, A Message to Black Youth. And see, of course, he was talking about how the challenge that they face navigating the society, which is basically set up really against them, which is oppressing them. You know, he's telling them some pretty hard truths about how they need to navigate that, you know, in that speech, you know, like very, very powerful. And of course, we hear it from Public Enemy with Say It Like It Really Is. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU as we celebrate Black History Month and look into the careers, the experiences of Paul Robeson. And James Baldwin, you know, James Baldwin being an African-American journalist and the 20th century, very prominent. And, of course, Paul Robeson, one of the greatest African-American singers of all time, one of the greatest internationalists as well, you know, in terms of building international solidarity between different groups of oppressed people around the world. You know, and, of course, I said I wasn't really going to speak that much. I was going to try to have these people really speak for themselves. So, trying to keep to that as much as possible. I know I talk a lot. It's true. I have to rein myself in sometimes. But this is... I want to play a talk which Paul Robeson gave in 1958 on KPFA KPFA radio in the United States. And this was after he basically had been blacklisted by the House on Un-American Activities in the McCarthyite era and stuff, and like his career never, of course, recovered from that, from the smearing he experienced as a communist, you know, as well as a black man, and but nonetheless, he was still completely unbowed, in spite of all the hatred being directed at him, and you'll see in this interview how, you know, he is still very much defiant, you know, still very much holds true to what he believes, and. I'm just going to let him speak for himself here. So this is Paul Robeson on KPFA in February 8th, 1958. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
The following program is brought to you by the Pacifica Program Service and Radio Archive.
I have in the studio with me Paul Robeson, who needs no introduction, and Harold Winkler, who is president of Pacifica Foundation, which operates KPFA, as most of you know. Mr. Robeson has been known and loved as an artist all over the world for many years, but he has also, I believe, attracted considerable and worldwide attention in his role as a world citizen and as a person who was very deeply concerned about the society in which he lived. I wonder, Mr. Robeson, if we could kick off by asking, when did you first become involved in the political aspects of...
May I first say how happy I am and privileged to be with you here, and how deeply I thank this station for its kindness throughout the years. I've been on two or three others this time, but always have been, know I've had a welcome here, so I want to thank you. I would say, as I indicate in a recent book, which is now out, will be on the stands pretty soon, Here I Stand, Story of My Life as I Tell It, not too autobiographical. It began when I was a little boy in Princeton, New Jersey. Strange to say. Technically, this is the shaping of my views. A Negro boy born in Princeton, New Jersey, in a college town where the students mainly came from the Deep South. You know, Princeton and Princeton, Harvard, and Yale was the sort of the Southern University of the North, whether you know that or not. And so I grew up in Jersey in a rather Southern atmosphere. And my father was a minister, and I was shaped against that background. Technically, I entered the sort of the arena in the United States of fighting for social justice for my people in a concert, when I was in a concert in St. Louis in 1947, in the Post-Dispatch, where I was singing at the Kiel Auditorium, one of the big auditoriums there, and the NAACP asked me in St. Louis at that time to come on a picket line because Negro people could not even sit in the theater, which was just across the street. And so I grabbed a banner, and lo and behold, I saw Walter Houston coming down the street. He was in the play. So Walter walked out and joined the picket line, too. And a few nights later, when I was doing the concert, I said that I could not quite resolve the contradiction between singing to an audience in St. Louis, where there was no segregation, of course, but also the same people had not, to my mind, were not fighting to see that my people could sit in the theater. It's been corrected since. And so I said that I was giving up my career technically for the moment to enter the realm of the day-to-day struggle of the Negro people especially.
And this was your first political action?
That was within this context. This is very important to get in the context. My first actual, to come back to your question, was in London in 1933. It isn't very well known, which I clarify in the book, that I went to play Showboat in London in 1928. Jerry Curran was with me and Oscar Hammerstein, and we had a great success. And then I did concerts in 1928, and I became domiciled and lived in England, domiciled there, paid my taxes there from 1928 until 1940, after the war began.
Does this mean, Mr. Robeson, that you spent most of your time in England during this period?
It meant that I came back now and then for concerts. I was here in Oakland many times, but I went back and spent most of my time in Great Britain.
That's perfectly true.
I was there in 1930, played Othello. So again, this is extremely important. At that time, I said, for the public to see, that I felt, I would explain it today in this light. We understand why many of my people have come to Oakland, to the vicinity, from Mississippi and from the South. There have been migrations into California, I understand today, from everywhere. But for many years, as you know, many of my people have left the South because the conditions in the North were better. Okay? I felt the pressure so much in 1928 that instead of stopping in New York, I just went on to London. That clear.
And did you feel no pressure there in sense?
I felt nowhere near the pressure. Now, that does not mean that you haven't the background of the English colonies and so forth.
Yes,
but
I wonder.
But the pressure, but I say it's a difference between right here now and, say, let's say, the Mississippi of Mr. Eastland. You understand?
Yes.
This is quite different. So America's quite different. There are great differences. So I found England that much more of a difference, that's all. I found Canada that way. When I was playing Othello some years ago, when we got to Toronto, the cast said to me after a week, well, Paul, why are you so different? The play is much deeper. You seem to be freer. I said, that's quite true. That's quite true. I'm in a country where there is no, this is not a question. I'm on a theater, on a stage with many other white actors. This is not a problem here. So obviously I feel freer. That's right. I'm in a different, feel the pressures that one would feel in the Deep South all the time, but it would interest you to know, and I've put it, that I And I feel any Negro, if he were honest, would have to say that even in our democracy as at present, that he is never any one second unconscious of the fact that he is a black American or a colored American. He can never be unconscious of it in any part of the United States.
Mr. Robeson, have you been back to England since the last war?
Oh, yes, I was back in 49.